Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and decided to become a piano player at age 13. From 1972 to 1976, he was the keyboardist for the Allman Brothers Band. Since 1985, he's been the keyboardist for the Rolling Stones. For 30-plus years, he and his wife, Rose Lane, have been tree farmers and were selected as the National Outstanding Tree Farmers of the Year in 1999. His name? The Fifth Stone, Chuck Lavelle. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the keyboardist for the Rolling Stones, the Fifth Stone, Chuck Lavelle. Chuck, welcome. What an honor to have you.
Oh, Jack, it's an honor to be on your show. Thanks so much for the invitation, my friend.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I had the most wonderful childhood growing up in Tuscaloosa. It's a lovely, lovely city, and, you know, we actually had moved to Tuscaloosa after living in Birmingham a few years and then down in Montgomery for a period of time, and I think I must have been in the fourth grade when we settled in Tuscaloosa. You know, I had a wonderful time there. It was a great city to grow up in.
One day at age 13, Ray Charles changed your life forever, Chuck Lavelle. Tell us about that day.
Well, I had already been playing the piano. I learned to play from my mother. She was not a professional or a teacher or anything, but she played for family enjoyment, and I always loved to listen to her play. I was the baby of the family, so I had gravitated towards the instrument already at a young age. But to jump forward to when I was 13 and my sister Judy had a date to go see Ray Charles at the Coliseum in Tuscaloosa, my mom and dad had their own appointment that night, and they said, well, why don't you take Chuck with you? And so I tagged along with my big sister to go to the concert, and it was just the most awesome thing I'd ever seen, Jack. It was a great, great performance. Of course, Ray, center stage, and that wonderful big voice and his incredible piano playing. But it was also the band, man. You know, you had Fathead Newman on saxophone. You had the Ray Letts, and it was just such a powerful, powerful band and a powerful, powerful experience for me as a young musician to see something that professional and that was, you know, just that good. And so it literally changed my life. I left that building that night saying, well, I know I don't want to be a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, a veterinarian or but I do know that if I could ever be in a band anywhere near that good, that would be my goal in life.
When you came home and told your mom and dad, I want to be in a band, what did they tell you?
Well, you know, they've always always encouraged me. And I think they had some trepidation about thinking about the life of a musician and a career, you know. I think they recognized my passion for music, and they encouraged me. And, you know, it was also around that same time that I had my first band, which was called The Misfits. And it was a pretty tight little band, if I may say so. The bass player was the son of the professor of music at the University of Alabama. So, you know, he certainly had talent and had grown up in a musical family. And the other musicians were quite good. And, you know, we formed that band and we started playing at the YMCA every Friday night. And we would rehearse in my mother's living room. She would allow us to move the furniture around, you know, move the sofas out of the way and set up our amplifiers and play. And so, you know, I think we were fairly disciplined for that age. We would learn the hits of the day that came across, you know, on the radio. So we were just loving it.
Let's jump ahead to 1972. You're 20 years old. and you become the keyboardist for the Allman Brothers Band. How did that ever happen?
Well, you know, I had moved to Macon, Georgia to pursue my musical career. There was a record label there called Capricorn Records, and they were beginning to have some success. The Allman Brothers Band was on that label. I had a connection there, so I went to just literally to check it out and see what the city was like and see if I thought there was some opportunity there. And indeed, I thought there was great opportunity there. So I moved there in 1970 and began to kind of work my way up the ladder. I played on some recording sessions. I had one band called Sundown that never really went anywhere, but we did do a record, and you know, that was exciting. And so that was the beginnings of it.
Tell us about your four-year run with the Allman Brothers Band.
Well, you know, after I had sort of worked my way up the ladder on Capricorn Records by playing in the band that I had called Sundown, and then further doing recording sessions with other artists, it came that in 1972, I was asked to play on Greg Allman's first solo record, which was called Lay Back. And, of course, that was a great opportunity for me. I had enjoyed Greg's music and was excited about the prospect of him doing a solo record and to be invited to play on it. And so we began the process, and then as time went on recording that album, there were these jam sessions that would occur sometimes at the end of the day in which the rest of the Allman Brothers Band would come down and join in, and we would just kind of have these free style jams, if you will, just pick a chord and go. And they really went very well. So after about 2 weeks of this, I get a call from the band's manager, a fellow named Phil Walden, saying, can you come to the offices of Capricorn for a meeting? And, you know, I'm wondering, what did I do wrong? You know, so I go in for this meeting. And as I walk in the door, there's all the rest of the Allman Brothers Band in there, which was kind of a surprise to me. And some pleasantries went around the room, and then the shoe dropped. And they said, you know, the guys feel like this has taken a really interesting direction. They really love the way you play, and they would like to know if you'd like to join the band. So after picking myself up off the floor, of course, I said, yes, I would. And that was a red-letter day for Chuck.
We're talking to Chuck Lavelle, and his solo on Jessica is one of the all-time great rock piano solos, and here's a little piece of it. Was Chuck Lavelle, Jessica, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Chuck Lavelle, who received a Grammy Achievement Award in 2012, Lifetime Achievement Award. Chuck, tell us about your first meeting with the Rolling Stones.
Well, what happened was through my work with the Allman Brothers Band, I became good friends with a gentleman named Bill Graham. Some of your listeners will probably know that Bill was often referred to as the impresario of rock. He ran both the Fillmore East and Fillmore West facilities that were very, very popular in the 60s. Of course, the East was in New York and the West was in San Francisco, and there were a lot of notable bands and musicians that played those facilities. And, of course, Bill went on to not only run those, but to be one of the biggest promoters in the country, promoting shows for all kinds of rock bands. And he had, befriended Phil Walden, again, who was the manager of the Allman Brothers Band back in the 70s. And I with my tenure with the Allman Brothers Band, Bill and I became friends. And then there was a gap of a couple of years that I didn't really have any contact with Bill. And out of the blue, I get a call from his office saying that the Rolling Stones were interested in me doing an audition. So, you know, bless him. God bless his soul. Bill passed away a number of years back now in a rather tragic helicopter accident. But, it was his suggestion that got me the audition, and it went well. And so there you go.
And you've been with them since 1985. Chuck, how do you explain the Rolling Stones' almost 50-year unprecedented run?
Well, it really is remarkable, isn't it? And actually, I came in 1982, and so last year when we were celebrating the band's 50th anniversary, which actually continued on into this year, I was celebrating my 30th year with the band, and now my 31st year. So it's just remarkable. And you know what? I would attribute it to, the success of the band, to the work ethic. A lot of people think, oh, yeah, rock and roll, that's easy, isn't it? You know, you just get in a room and bang on some guitars and some drums and pound some things out, put something down, put it out, maybe you get lucky. But that's not the case, man. These guys, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, some of the greatest songwriters ever in rock and roll, I think we can all agree on that, and have recorded so many records. I mean, I think at this point, when you count all of the reissues and the original records and everything together, there's well over 100 releases that the band has put out, and that's just remarkable. And I think even more remarkable is that after 50 years of this band, they continue to be creative. They still write songs. They still get into the studio, and I'm privileged to go into the studio with them and to record, and then they still want to get out there in front of the public and do it live, and they're in fabulous shape to do that. And this last run that we had that started in 2012 and ran over into 2013 has just been an incredible success. And it's also been fun, Jack. You know, every time that we get to walk out on that stage, it is a privilege and an honor to be able to do that, and I think we all have that same feeling.
Chuck, what is it like walking onto that stage and performing live in front of tens of thousands of screaming, roaring, adoring fans?
Well, it's a lot of fun. it is a thrill. You know, what can you say? It's a rush, and it can send chills up your spine. But you know what? All my life as a musician and as a performer, I've just had this thing that it doesn't really matter if I'm in a room with one person playing the piano and singing, or if I'm in a room with 20 people or 50 or 50,000 or whatever it might be. You know, I'm going to focus on what I'm doing. I'm going to enjoy myself, and I'm going to give the best performance that I know how to give. And I think all of us feel that way. We want to focus on what we do as a band, to try to deliver the goods. And, you know, when people come to these concerts, the goal is to get them to forget all of their problems, anything that's bothering them, any tension, make all of that go away and be pure entertainment and pure living, if you will, for the time that we're on that stage.
February 5th, 2006, at halftime of Super Bowl 40, you're here in Ford Field, downtown Detroit, and the five of you perform the halftime routine for Super Bowl. What was that like?
Well, you know, I've been so lucky in my career to meet a lot of goals. Even going back to the days with the Allman Brothers Band and moving forward to my own band, Sea Level, that I had, and to be able to record with so many different artists, including Eric Clapton, and to perform with Eric. I was with Eric for 2 years to do the last tour with George Harrison. I've been able to meet a lot of goals. But I'll tell you, Jack, you know, it's not easy to meet that goal of being on that stage at the Super Bowl for halftime. And that was just more special than I can say. You know, you're doing the real deal. You're out there. Sometimes, I'm sure your listeners understand, sometimes these performances are in part recorded, you know, pre-recorded, so that some of the action is actually lip-synced, or, you know, there might be some little tricks being used. But with the Rolling Stones, no, sir. It's what you see is what you get. We get up there and we play, and that's the way we did it at halftime in 2006, and it was just an incredible thrill.
Chuck, you've been doing this for over 40 years. Were there two or three venues that you've played in that you thought, wow?
Well, there's been a lot in that regard. You know, I think one of the first ones that comes to my mind is, I think it might have been 1974 when we did a tour with Greg Allman as a solo artist. We played these beautiful theaters across the country, including Carnegie Hall and including the Academy of Music and so many other of these beautiful historic theaters. And that's just really special. Those are wonderful rooms with great acoustics. You know, an interesting size room when you're talking about somewhere between maybe 2,500 and 5,000 seats. Those are very, very special rooms, and I've always enjoyed playing them. But when you jump forward and look at some of the other opportunities we've had with the Allman Brothers Band, in 1973, we broke the record that Woodstock had held. We played a show with the Grateful Dead and the band, and the Allman Brothers Band, that we had over 600,000 attend in Watkins Glen, New York. And then with the Rolling Stones, another couple of shows that really stand out to me was after the wall fell in 1989, we were touring in Europe in 1990, and we got to play in the city of Prague. And, of course, they were just experiencing their newfound freedom at that time. And the posters in town read, "Tanks roll out, Stones roll in." We got to meet with President Václav Havel. We played a concert to 126,000 people in a area that a place that was formerly used for communist demonstrations. And so it was really great to bring rock and roll into that venue. And then on the Bigger Bang Tour, just a couple of years ago, we played in Rio de Janeiro on the beach, Copacabana Beach, to over a million people. The best estimate they could come up with was 1.5 million people. So that was an extraordinary day, and those are some of my memories of some of the best shows and places we've played.
We're talking to Chuck Lavelle, and here's a portion of "You Can't Always Get What You Want." And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and with Chuck Lavelle, the author of many books, including Between Rock and a Home Place. Chuck, music transcends all languages, all races, all cultures. How is that?
Isn't it great? It's the universal language. It's really that simple. You know, even if you don't know the language that a certain song may be in, It doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. You know, when we first went to Japan, it just really amazed me. And this would be, of course, with the Rolling Stones. And this would have been back in, I think it would have been 1990, as a matter of fact. I noticed that a lot of the fans, you know, didn't speak the English language, yet they could say every word to the lyrics of the song. Yeah, and you could see them mouthing the words. So it's just an extraordinary thing, but it does transcend, as you say, all cultures and ages and race and everything. And it's truly the universal language.
I quote you now, "Music for me has always been about colors, emotions, and feelings, rather than notes on a page or chords." What do you mean by that?
Well, you know what? That really came from my mom. When I was very young and learning to play the piano, and she would have me up on that stool, and she would show me, you know, little simple melodies and chords and things, and sometimes leave me to my own resources and just suggest that I would make something up, you know. And she was always encouraging me, but one of the things she would do and say to me, Jack, was she would say things like, "Well, Chuck, what would it sound like if you had an argument with your best friend? Or what would it sound like if you hit a home run, if you were at the plate and you just smacked that ball out of the park? What would that sound like? Or what would it sound like if there was a big storm outside?" So she would give me all of these things to think about, and that's what I mean when music has never been notes on a page for me. It's always been about these emotions and colors and feelings, and how do you translate that on a musical instrument via a song. And so when I'm doing a recording session or when I'm learning a new piece of material that someone has written, that's what I'm always looking for. How can I find something on my instrument, the piano or the organ, you know, keyboards, that can help emphasize what this song is saying? And that's what music has always been about for me.
Another quote, "The joy of my career has been dancing with all these world-class partners." And they've been the Allman Brothers, the Stones, Eric Clapton, Aretha Franklin, George Harrison, on and on and on. Talk about that.
Well, yes, that has been the joy of my career. You know, I think any musician I know or artist I know would be very happy if they could say, "Look, I've had success in my career in this one setting, you know, as a solo artist or with a band or whatever it might be." But really the joy of my career is being able to play with all these wonderful artists that you've just mentioned. And you know, in recent times, I've worked with Martina McBride, Miranda Lambert, and even more recently than that, with John Mayer, who I think is just an outstanding artist of our time. And you always learn something from that kind of setting that you might be able to apply in some way, shape, fashion, or form the next time you get an opportunity to work with a different artist. And, you know, I consider myself a student of life, not just of music, but of life. And, you know, I think we can all take the information that we have from a setting and you know, when some other situation comes up and we think, well, how did that go down and what can I learn from this last situation and apply to the situation at hand? So that has been a joy of my career, to be able to play with all, and not just the artists, by the way, the musicians that you play with in a recording session, or the musicians that you're privileged to work with live with these other artists. And believe me, I've worked with some great, great musicians. And again, I always learn something from them.
Someday in the future, a friend comes over and asks if you could play one song. Chuck Lavelle, what song do you play them?
Oh, my goodness. What a question. Well, you know, you were kind enough to showcase Jessica earlier in our discussion. And that song certainly holds a special place in my heart. You know, it was the first song that really gave me the opportunity to, you know, to try to put rock and roll on the radio with a piano solo. And fortunately, it went well. And I still get to hear that song on the radio from time to time, and it's always a thrill. So Jessica is certainly up on that list. But, you know, it's hard not to mention some Rolling Stones songs that are so fun to play, Honky Tonk Women, or Can't Always Get What You Want, or Satisfaction, or Jumpin' Jack Flash, any of those, and Start Me Up, you know, or the great opportunity I had with Eric Clapton when we did the Unplugged record, and had some great opportunities with songs like Alberta, Alberta, and Old Love, and you know, so there's a lot I could name, but certainly Jessica is a standout.
Over 40 plus years, there's been some nights on stage where you just didn't have that feeling. How did you get through?
Well, you know, I think staying focused, you know, being open to the spirits, if you will. Maybe that sounds a little weird and outside the box, but, you know, I think all of us have heard, I don't know, athletes and artists, musically and otherwise, that say things flow through you to your instrument or to the brush when you're doing a painting or to, you know, whatever task it is that you have at hand if you're an athlete. And I think that's true. I think you just have to open up yourself spiritually and mentally to just let ideas flow freely and say, how can I make this song better this time around than it did the last time? And, you know, sometimes that's not easy. I think I've probably played those songs that I mentioned of the Rolling Stones probably, you know, more than 1,000 times, or probably a lot more than 1,000 times each. And you just have to remember, maybe think about the first time you heard that song and what it meant to you then, and how can you interpret it now and get that same feeling. So, you know, those are some of the ideas and techniques that we use as musicians.
We're talking to Chuck Lavelle, and for the last 30-plus years, he and his wife, Rose Lane, have been tree farmers. And in 1999, they were named National Tree Farmers of the Year. When we come back, we'll ask him about that aspect of his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Chuck Lavelle, the author of Forever Green, The Tree Farmer, Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, Sustainable. Chuck, talk to us about one of God's many miracles that we call trees.
Well, they are miracles, aren't they, Jack? I firmly believe that, you know, could anyone imagine a world without trees and forests? Of course we could not. I think it's the most important natural resource that we have. Let's just talk for a moment, if we may, about all the things that trees and forests give us. They give us materials to build our homes and our schools and our churches. They give us materials to make books and magazines and newspapers and packaging products. They give us musical instruments. What about that marvelous thing that has given me such a great career and so much joy in my life? Where does that come from? Well, it comes from the resource of wood, as do Keith Richards' guitars and Eric Clapton's guitars and Charlie Watts' drums and so many other musical instruments. But not only those things. Trees clean our air. They sequester our carbon in the air. They clean our water by filtering the water as it goes to our streams and rivers all over the world. And they also provide home and shelter to all manner of wildlife. And one of the great quotes that I've always loved is by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once said, "In the woods, we return to reason and faith." And I think that's so true. You know, there's just a certain spirituality that we have when we're in the forest. So, again, I think it's the most important resource that we have.
Speaking of in the woods, reason and faith, one of the greatest experiences I've had, and I've had it many times, is to go to Muir Woods, just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. That woods is more spiritual and majestic than any church or cathedral I've ever been in. Chuck Lavelle, how do you explain that?
You know, I myself have been to Muir Woods many times, and every time I go, it gives me the feeling that you just described, Jack. It's just the only word I can use is spiritual. It's just incredible to walk among trees that are 1,200, 1,400, 1,500, 1,600 years old, and to think about all that has gone on in our planet during their lifetime. And then just visually and sensually to be amongst those incredible giants and just feel the power that they hold. But, you know, you can get the same feeling from walking in our beautiful southeastern pine forest here. We may not have trees that are that old here in the southeast. You know, there are some trees that have been around for hundreds of years here that still exist. And, you know, it's always a very moving experience to do that. But, you know, there's just something beyond words that I think we can agree that we experience when we are in a magnificent forest like that.
Tell us about your 2,200-acre tree plantation that you and your wife, Rose Lane, have created near Macon, Georgia.
Well, you know, here's the way that went down. When Rose Lane and I, and by the way, we just celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary, so we've been together a long time. But when we were first dating and finally got serious and said, let's get married, Rose Lane said, well, come and meet my family. And I said, well, tell me about your family. And she said, well, we're farmers, and I want you to meet them. So, you know, we went out into the country, met her dad and her brother and, you know, her mom and just the grandmother and who was alive at the time. And immediately I understood after just spending a few minutes with them, but certainly that understanding got to be greater and greater the more time I spent with them, about the passion and the love and the dedication that they have for the land. And as we would walk the fields, you know, they had row crops, they had cattle, and they also tended forest land. But as you walk through any of that and just hear them talk about, you know, how they run the place and how long it's been in the family, that passion and was so clear to me. And so go forward to 1982 or 81 it was, when her grandmother passed away. And because her father had preceded the grandmother in death, Rose Lane had an inheritance from her grandmother of about 1,000 acres of land. And it became our responsibility. You know, first of all, of course, you go through the period of grief of the loss of a loved one, and her grandmother was the matriarch of the family, you know, and that was certainly a difficult thing to get through. But when you come out the other side, you say, well, now it's our responsibility to look after this land. And the mantra that any landowner has, Jack, is you want to leave it in better shape than you found it. And so that's been our goal all along from that day forward and to this day. And, you know, we've been very, very fortunate to be able to add to the land that we started with. And as you mentioned, we're actually now we have about 2,800 acres. And, you know, I just never get enough of being in the woods, of being outdoors, of walking in the woods, of working in the woods, and doing things that I think are going to improve this land, improve it for the wildlife, improve it for the forest, improve it for the flora and the fauna that exist on it. And it's a privilege to be able to be a steward of the land and hopefully a good steward.
What do forestry and music, Chuck Lovell, have in common?
Well, first of all, I would say again that the resource of wood gives us these musical instruments. So that's a direct connection. You know, where do they come from? They come literally from the trees that are felled and then so carefully crafted into these wonderful instruments. And, you know, that, again, is the direct connection that we have. But I think also there's a deeper connection. You know, you and I were talking earlier about the feeling that you have when you're walking in a muir woods or when you're walking in just any beautiful forest, and there's a certain feeling of spirituality. And I think that translates when you're playing music, too, that, you know, if you free your mind up enough and allow the spirits, if you will, to come inside and let you play some phrases that you're not sure where they come from, but they come from someplace deep. And I think there's a connection between those two things as well.
Chuck, as our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, be yourself. Find your passion. Find what you're good at. And that, you know, that could be anything, Jack. It could be in the medical field. It could be as an administrator. It could be as a teacher and instructor. It could be as a musician. It could be as a visual artist. But look and leave yourself open to finding that passion. And then once you find it, give it everything you've got and be grateful that you have it.
Chuck Lavelle, you've done that. And because of that, you've brought great joy to every one of us in America and around the world these past 40-plus years. Please keep up the great work.
Thanks, Jack. It was truly an honor and a pleasure to speak with you today. All the best.
God bless. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.